Corporate bosses across America have been sputtering in outrage at you working stiffs this summer, spewing expletives about the fact that while the U.S. economy has been coming back, you haven't. Labor shortage, they squeal, lazily accusing the workforce of mass laziness. They charge insultingly that millions of workers got used to laying around during the pandemic, noting that there is now an abundance of jobs open for everything from restaurant workers to nurses. The bosses and their political dogs bark that you people need to get back in the old harness and start pulling again. Adding a nasty bite to their bark, several GOP governors cut off unemployment benefits to people, hoping to force them to work. Other businesses have proffered signing bonuses, free dinner coupons, and other lures, while such notoriously mingy outfits as McDonald's and Walmart have even upped their wage scale in an effort to draw workers. Yet, no go. In fact, to the astonishment of the economic elite, the employment flow this year is going the other way. Record numbers of current workers in all sorts of jobs in every section of the country are voluntarily walking away. There's even an official economic measurement of this phenomena called the quits rate, and it is surging beyond anything our economy has experienced in modern history. In April, 4 million workers quit. In May, another 3.6 million left. And in June, 3.9 million said adios. The quits are so unexpected and so widespread that pundits have started dubbing this year the Great Resignation. This is Jim Hightower saying, what's wrong with people? Why are such staggering numbers of Americans failing to do their jobs? But wait, maybe that's the wrong question. Maybe the corporate system's jobs are failing the people. Consider this. The most common comment by those who are walking out is, I hate my job. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we've been talking about the striking workers at Nabisco, five warehouses and plants across the country. And it's about time. This idea that you can work people 60, 70, 80 hours a week and expect them to not want family time, and then come back and say, no, we want to give you an alternative schedule where we cheat you out of overtime and all of the things that they're trying to do. Eventually, you push people to where they go, enough is enough. And I think having lived through the pandemic, I think finally a number of working people have gone, screw this. We're going to make some demands that they haven't made in decades. And here to share some thoughts on, what the Nabisco workers are going through and maybe some insight in what's going on. I've asked Jordan Zacharin to come talk with us. Jordan's a media producer over at More Perfect Union. You can follow them at More Perfect US on Twitter, perfectunion.us, their website. Jordan, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
So I think this is a good thing. It's a nationwide strike. You've got hundreds of workers who have finally said, you know what, we've been abused and used while given the name of hero and essential for long enough. Enough is enough. No contract, no snacks.
The great Danny DeVito coined that term. So he got a lot of people interested actually in the Nabisco strike because he got his authentication his blue check mark taken away for time on Twitter. So Danny DeVito did a great job for the working people. And yeah, it's been, it started out in Portland, BCTGM, the workers there, they walked out, like 300, 400, 500 workers there walked out. I think they're in their third week or second or third week at this point. And then the following week, it was folks in Richmond, Virginia. There was another plant there, Richmond. And then the next, and a few days later in the next week, it was Chicago. And so I think it was last week it was Chicago. So the three big plants that are remaining there in Nabisco, of course, owned by Mondelez, the gigantic food conglomerate, and then two distribution places, and those are in Georgia and Aurora, Colorado, are also on strike. They're trying to cut off all the supply of Oreos and Chips Ahoy and all that across the country, and I think they are making a dent so far.
No, and I think it's an important one. I think it's now about time that working people say enough. But this has gotten such attention, and people are, you know, everybody I talk to from those areas are supportive, because when you start hearing about the working conditions, working in 100 plus degree heat all the time, when you hear about, you know, the lack of sanitary facilities, 70, 80 hour work weeks mandatory, and now they want to eviscerate the 8 hour day, you go, wait a second, bridge too far.
Yeah, you know, so earlier this year, I think it was in February and March, they shut down two gigantic legacy plants, Mondelez did, and like I said, they own Nabisco, one in Fairlawn, New Jersey, which employed hundreds and hundreds of workers, been there since the, you know, 60, 70, 80 years. And a lot of people got laid off. People had worked there their entire careers, just thrown away. They also got rid of a giant plant in Atlanta, or the Atlanta area in Georgia. And again, you know, that was over 1,000 workers who were just, you know, sacrificed after an entire year of being, you know, working there during COVID, during those crazy hours. And so, you know, the folks that are, you know, remaining in those three plants, those three manufacturing places, they have not had a contract. A lot of them, you know, some of them did resolve to have a contract, but a lot of them haven't had a contract since 2016 or something like that. And so they've been working in, you know, 2018, they did an impasse. They, because they had not come to an agreement, Mondelez just unilaterally froze their pensions. And so all these people now had, you know, 401ks, which were pennies on the dollar compared to what they would get with their pensions. So, you know, we talked to folks who've been working there 30, 40 years, all of a sudden can't retire as they had intended, you know, in their 60s. Now they're, oh, I'm going to be working until my 70s plus. And so all these folks are just sick of it. And, you know, in Chicago especially, they already closed half the plant in 2016, I believe. And so they saw, you know, 300 of the coworkers thrown aside. Some of them eventually got jobs again at the new plant once people, the other half of the plant once people retired and, you know, they phased people out. But, you know, lots of people left out in the cold. And I think they're saying, look, you're going to send our jobs to Mexico. That's what you're going for. We're going to get what we can out of you.
No, ultimately, that is the goal. I mean, and I'm never going to buy a Montezuma's Revenge Oreo. That is never going to happen. When they closed the Fairlawn, New Jersey plant, I'm like, you know, when I would pick up a bag and I flip it over to check the label, it better say Fairlawn, New Jersey on it. Now that they've closed it, there's nothing there. I'll never buy another Oreo again unless it's made in the U.S. And I think we, the consumers, have to show our solidarity with these workers by saying, look, we're not going to buy things made in Mexico. You make food here in this country. In fact, it should be much more local, you know, like New Jersey's close enough. Atlanta, I'm sorry, too far away. We need local distribution, local production for local consumption. At least that's my view on it.
Well, you know, between this and Frito-Lay, and, you know, Nabisco makes a whole lot of food, a whole lot of snacks, and, you know, Nabisco's owned by Mondelez, and they do lots of other stuff as well. You know, they have drinks, they have food, they have snacks, and Frito-Lay, of course, owned by PepsiCo. The sheer number of brands and companies they own, if you were to look at the back of your snack or the soda or whatever you're going to buy, in my grocery store here in the city, it's not a huge one. Most of the snacks at this point, you know, if I'm not buying those things, I'm not going to be buying Nabisco and Frito-Lay. Most of the snacks you want to eat, most of the sodas you want to drink, Coca-Cola is not a good corporation either. So I'm sure that'll be out of the question soon enough. It shows you how much corporate consolidation actually controls these markets, and how much, you know, when there's no competition, they can move jobs to Mexico, or like you said, get rid of the 8-hour workday. You know, in Nabisco, they want to change, they want to have this alternative schedule where, you know, anything after 8 hours is overtime. You know, you get paid time and a half, and on weekends you get, you know, two times because you're working on weekends, you're not with your family. They want to change that. They say, oh, we're going to give you more work-life balance by giving you 12-hour workdays without any overtime. You got to pass 40 hours a week to get overtime, so they can work you three 12-hour days, you know, and then put you off schedule and then make you work a Sunday or something like that. And they're not paying you any overtime. Tens of thousands of dollars it's going to cost people and, like, their health by working in these horrible conditions, sweating their heads off in places where there's, like, you know, one of them said it's like being baked yourself. You know, you're in a bakery, the fans and the AC are on the food. You're being baked just as much. And so between those conditions and the way they've treated the thousands of workers they've already laid off, it shows you how little, until, like you said, the consumer starts taking action as well. It starts saying, I'm not going to buy this stuff. I'm going to go for alternatives. I'm going to go for local stuff. I'm going to try and, you know, eat eat healthier, I guess, until you treat your workers better. You know, it's just so corporate consolidation has such a huge impact on workers, and we don't have to think about that.
Yeah, now Nabisco is saying, you know, we're doing just fine. Production isn't affected. But I saw a story, and you could help me if it's wrong. But I saw a story out in Portland that a train literally backed up and didn't deliver flour. I don't know how, when a train is willing to back up to not deliver you flour, how production is at normal levels.
Yeah, no, that story, it's an interesting one. And that story is almost correct. So basically what happens is, and I spoke to one of the workers there, they have the train will have to flip a switch to go towards the Nabisco factory, you know, and they saw a picket line and the workers were in the union, the train railroad workers said, we're not going to deliver. We're not going to cross that line. So they changed their route so that they did not throw the switch so that they would just skip over the factory. And so, yeah, the spirit of the story is correct. They are not going to cross the picket line. And apparently Mondelez and Nabisco were not happy that they had people on the picket line on the rail tracks. But I mean, look, these are the people that run this factory. These are the people who know these things. They know how it all goes. They've been the one unloading this stuff for so many years. They knew exactly how to force a stop. And they did that. And, you know, it's been a lot of great solidarity, I think, in Portland and in Chicago and Richmond. I'm just hearing stories. I know in Portland coming up on Saturday, there's going to be a big rally with, you know, some city council folks. And, you know, lots of unions have been coming out, showing solidarity and trying to, you know, the last thing, the big one we covered was in Topeka, Kansas, where, look, you know, union power is not nearly as strong in Kansas, the right to work state. But in Oregon and Portland, I think it's a little bit stronger. There's been a lot of, you know, activist groups that have been out there with them, you know, adding to the picket lines and the size of it and keeping people in solidarity. And so this is definitely going on longer than Frito-Lay did.
Now, ultimately, it's going to come down to we, the people, supporting these. And as I said, I am not buying a Nabisco product or a Mondelez product if I can help it. And I do try and check every label I can. I will not knowingly buy any of their products until these folks get a contract. So not just no contract, no snacks, no contract, no nothing. I'm staying away from Mondelez stuff entirely. But here's the thing. This is going to be, I think, when we look back at 2021, the year of workers finally saying enough is enough and strikes. You know, I just talked with a woman, a nurse from St. Vincent's up in Worcester, Mass., who they've been on strike for, you know, what seems like forever, since March 8th, I believe. And the community support that they're getting there for a lengthy strike is really incredible. So I think working people are finally waking up. In 2009-10, I was hoping for this moment, but I think now we're really at a moment where people are like, hey, I've worked way too hard for way too long, and I'm still struggling to get by. Enough is enough. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, you know, we've seen, especially folks who are working in the factories who worked through the pandemic, nurses, I mean, how you don't want to help nurses out, how you do not want to, you know, give them their fair share, let them unionize is, you know, beyond me, you know, the calling them healthcare heroes and then treating them like nothing. Right. And so I think the community, people are seeing that, you know, these people risk their lives to keep the world moving as the rest of us, like, you know, stayed inside because we had to, because of the pandemic. And so, you know, look, I'm not, and certainly not in corporate PR, but it certainly is not a good move for all these places to say, hey, healthcare heroes work here, or hey, you know, thank you to our frontline workers, your essential workers who help make these snacks, but also we're not gonna pay you, we're not gonna give you any sort of benefits, we're gonna freeze your retirement, we're going to make it more hell for you. That's not a good look, and I don't know what kind of business strategy that is, but I think people are really seeing this sort of solidarity, people coming together. And you know, everyone was cast aside during the pandemic. You know, like, it was lucky that there were unemployment benefits that, you know, a lot of people didn't get them, but everyone's cast aside during the pandemic. And I think people remember that.
No, I think you're right. I want to get your thoughts on this story that's breaking out of Massachusetts. Evidently, the state has certified a ballot measure, you know, to target gig workers, to ensure that they never become employees. Is that what I'm seeing here?
Yeah, so they're trying to do the, you know, Uber and Lyft, and they're trying to do the whole Prop 22 playbook in Massachusetts. They obviously, Prop 22, they tricked or hoodwinked California voters into thinking they were helping gig workers by saying they were going to be guaranteed benefits. Basically just took away the right to be employees, the right to strike, right to, you know, right to negotiate for their own contracts. And so it passed. There's a lot of regret on that. And, you know, it got invalidated by a court saying that this is, you know, you can't just put a limit on this. You can't, they tried in California, it would take 7/8 of the legislature to repeal it, which is almost impossible. And so that was, you know, in California right now, that's been invalidated. trying to do it in Massachusetts, trying to run that playbook again. Hopefully, you know, War Perfect Union certainly working on this. There's a bit more savviness and, you know, community awareness of it in that sort of thing. They paid $200 million in California to Lyft and Uber and Instacart and DoorDash to make that happen there. You know, it's incumbent, I think, upon the Biden NLRB that's going to be trying, and, you know, they're going to be enforcing things a lot more. They've got, you know, great new general counsel. And I think Department of Labor, I think it's, you know, at some point, I mean, look, they haven't done much lately, right? Maybe there'll be some elements of the PRO Act and reconciliation, but it's going to take, I think, some federal power, some federal intervention to avoid all these places getting these things on the ballot. Because, you know, if they can do it in California and, you know, got Massachusetts, it's not going to be a problem to get it done in Florida, in Ohio, and all these other places.
No, it's an excellent point. But, you know, I sit and I look at the sums of money that these companies spend. You know, Uber and Lyft, those companies, you know, came up with $200 million to run their campaign there. Amazon spent $200 million to break that contract, the election vote there in Bessemer. This hospital in Massachusetts has spent already in excess of $100 million to deny workers safe staffing levels. If there's all this money to deny workers basic rights and basic safety, isn't there money to help pay them better wages and to make safer working conditions? Or is it really just all about power and control?
I mean, I think it's about power and control. You know, you don't want a rolling stone to gather moss. You know, they do not want They do not want to create this sort of momentum, and they do not want to be stuck in negotiations with people going forward. If you unionize, it's not just the first contract, right? It's, you know, the contract after that, after that, after that. It's, you know, retirement. It's all those things. So I guess they see it as like a one-time payment, you know, one-time, a gigantic payment. And it says a lot that they have that money to just splash out. But it's certainly all about power. I think it's the same thing with the, you know, Democrats and the filibuster. If, you know, it's not just about rescuing democracy to them. It's about, or, you know, passing the PRO Act. It's about, oh, all of a sudden people will be able to demand more progressive change. And we don't want to open the door to that. And I think that's exactly what's happening with these, you know, anti-union campaigns.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in favor of doing away with the filibuster and only having them in the old school thought process. You know, I still remember Mr. Smith goes to Washington. If you want a filibuster, you get your jug, you get your lozenges, you hit the floor, and you hold it as long as you want. If it's really that important, keep telling me why you're against whatever it is. If it's the minimum wage, tell me why you think people should work for a buck an hour. Tell me how you think that's going to help the economy. If you're against the right of workers to organize, hold the floor and tell me why. Or just read the phone book. I don't care. But if it's that important, you should have to have some kind of act. You shouldn't be able to just go, yeah, what? I've decided no.
Right. I mean, it's lazy is really what it is. And the fact that Democrats are allowing it to happen. It's not about, you know, preserving Senate comedy. It's not about preserving traditions. It's not about that. It's they do not want, you know, I was talking to one Democratic lawmaker about this who's on the progressive side, saying they just do not want, you know, they do not want this opportunity for people, for progressive activists to say, hey, look, now do this, now do this, now do this. You know, if Biden was to get rid of student debt, then what happens to medical debt, right? And so I think that this is about power in the same way it is about power with the unions, with and Prop 22. You know what I mean? They are trying to preserve this sort of power structure. And until, you know, there's enough. I mean, we saw all those Democrats trying to destroy the reconciliation bill, right? They just because they have a D next to their name doesn't mean that they're on the side of working people. And so it's about taking power. And I think working people and, you know, union members are understanding that more than ever.
Yeah, I've always been harder on Democrats than I have been on Republicans, because I believe Democrats should be better and know better. But, you know, the major labor law reform that I had hoped for through my lifetime, going back to Carter, and the possibility of undoing Taft-Hartley, Bill Clinton and the strike replacement, Barack Obama and the Employee Free Choice Act. They've always found a way to screw it up, and I've always been harder on them because I expect attacks from Republicans. I expect them to be the voice of corporate America, and they never let me down. Democrats often do.
Yeah, it's like when a parent or a teacher says, you say, why are you being harder on me? And it's because they expect more out of you. You know, they can have all this pro-worker rhetoric, even with abortion rights. You know, they can say, oh, look, we're going to fight for Roe v. Wade. But until you expand the Supreme Court, until you get rid of the filibuster, until you actually fight the fight. You know, it's, you know, just fundraising.
Boy, you are so spot on. But Jordan, I appreciate the time and the work that you guys do over there at More Perfect Union. Incredible videos. I hope folks will go to your Twitter page. More Perfect US is the Twitter handle. We'll get links out on social media. I can follow the work they do there. Also go to their website, perfectunion.us. We'll get that out as well. Jordan, I appreciate you taking some time. Keep up the great work you guys do.
Much appreciated. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff. Jordan Zacharin, media producer there at More Perfect Union. Check out the website, perfectunion.us. Quick break. Right back. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day nearly 500,000 textile workers from Maine to Alabama walked off the job in a general strike. The United Textile Workers had launched an organizing campaign the year before. Within months, their membership had grown from 15,000 to well over 250,000. Working conditions and pay were abysmal. Normal work weeks averaged 55 hours. Child labor was widespread, and workers were always in fear of mill closings, pay cuts, and firings for suspected union activity. In the South, the industry had essentially been in a depression since the early 20s. The key issue was the stretch out. Workers were routinely expected to complete an increasing amount of work at the same rate and wage. For a brief moment, workers hoped their conditions would change when President Roosevelt signed the Code of Fair Competition the previous summer. It raised wages, limited hours, and prohibited child labor. It also allowed for union organizing. But the mill owners maneuvered around the code effectively, and the Textile Relations Board refused most workers' complaints. Fed up, workers walked out of the mill by the hundreds of thousands. They used the flying squadron tactic employed by Minneapolis Teamsters earlier that year, traveling from town to town, from mill to mill, calling workers out on strike. Mill owners were shocked. Within days, strikers confronted thousands of police and scabs. More than 40,000 National Guardsmen were called out in 16 states. Over the course of the strike, 16 people would be killed and hundreds more injured. After 22 days, union leaders called off the strike when President Roosevelt promised a government survey of industry conditions. It was an outrage, a betrayal, and a defeat felt for decades. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some craziness on the COVID front. New Jersey woman. And you got to love these people who think that they're never going to get caught. Evidently, she was using the Instagram handle anti-vax mama. Like, that's not going to catch someone's attention. Evidently, she's been charged in a conspiracy to sell hundreds of fake coronavirus vaccine cards. And doing it on social media. Like, you're not going to get caught, you dimwit. And look, these people, they deserve to go to jail. Jails are usually filled with stupid people. Right here, this is someone who should go. We should have a place for them. But here's the good thing. The good thing is more people are getting vaccinated. According to the CDC, we're up to a 63.5% of all U.S. adults 18 and older are fully vaccinated. In California, more than 80% of eligible Californians now have, I guess, at least one dose of the vaccine. Because, hey, they're seeing what's happening to their brethren in the southern states and the spike that's going on and going, that guy I used to listen to on the radio, he's dead. Maybe I should do something. In fact, the latest Axios Ipsos poll puts it at just 20% of Americans now say that they're not very likely or not at all likely to get the vaccine. That is the absolute lowest number since they've been polling this. Which means that, you know, they're seeing people dying. As if the first 600,000 weren't enough. the fact that we may have another 100 by December 1st has motivated some folks because it's finally hit their neck of the woods maybe and rushing through it. Now, in Colorado, a state panel has approved emergency measures to require the staffs at hospitals or health or nursing homes or other healthcare facilities to require vaccinations. Colorado's finally going, we haven't done anything because evidently there's still about 30% of the healthcare people not vaccinated, which really isn't great. Not great because, you don't want people coming to work sick, especially when you're talking about people who may already have other problems of being sick. May be immune compromised, may be who knows what. I don't know that you want somebody who's hanging around, not vaccinated. Not a good thing, I don't think. But, we'll see how that plays out. Now in Florida, Florida is now all the school districts that were afraid that Death Santis was going to hold back their pay or arrest them or who knows what. They're now going back and reconsidering their decisions because a judge has struck down DeSantis's death order. So look, that's a step in the right direction. And our governor here where I'm at in Pennsylvania, and good on Tom Wolf. I'm a big Tom Wolf fan. Tom has come out and said, look, we're gonna require masks to be worn by kids K through 12. It's just what's going to happen. If school boards aren't smart enough to help protect their students, this is where someone's got to make the choice. And Governor Wolf has done that here. Interesting, in Idaho, the governor there, the Republican governor, said there are only four. This is the, and they've got it down to the number, only four ICU beds left in the entire state. Now, look, Idaho can't have all that many. But when you go, there's only four left. And, well, I can't imagine their vaccine rate is all that high. Start worrying. Start worrying. Now, a good story. Not a good one, but at least a consistent one. I look at this guy. His name was Robert David Steele. I say was because Robert David Steele's dead. He was one of the original Q kook COVID conspiracy folks. And what he did that I find a little bit honorable, former CIA guy, conspiracy theorist. To his last dying breath, he held that COVID was a hoax. And I give him credit for that. I've said it from the beginning. If you were going to double and triple and quadruple down on that it's a hoax, and that you're gonna die because you see the ventilator tube coming, might as well stick with it to the end. Don't change directions and beg after that. Go right through it. I give him credit for that. And I know I shouldn't. I know that's kind of cruel. But I'll tell you, I kind of find it, somewhat honorable on his part. Good for him. I hope whatever's next, he doesn't find that to be a hoax, too. And finally, on the COVID front, Joe Rogan, the powerful podcaster, signed a $100 million contract with Spotify. Wow. He's been one of those guys who's been one of the report said dangerously dismissive. He's been one of the anti-vax kind of folks, even though he did say that he was in favor of people getting vaccinated. Nobody really knows what his official position is, but he's been dismissive in the past. Evidently over the weekend, he tested positive for the coronavirus and did a little video saying that, I guess I got it, and we threw everything at it. He did the deworming thing. He did the monoclonal antibodies. He did the hydro stuff. He did everything. He did it all. To be very aggressive, threw everything at it, he said. And I said earlier, I go, I don't really care that he took all these drugs. I don't, because I know that he's got $100 million. He can afford to have a doctor come and go, here's the right dose of the deworming drug. you know, here's a reasonable dose of this to help get you through this, and maybe it helps you, maybe it doesn't. They're going to give him a non-lethal dose. It's not like he was Bubba who walked into Tractor Supply and said, give me the Wormin drug, and came out with a bucket load of it and then downed it with a can of Pepsi. I mean, it's not that. So I don't really care about him. I do care the fact that the messaging out of this is, you know, he's going to be, I beat it because I took these crazy drugs. Well, the fact is, the guy's fairly healthy. He was probably going to make it through regardless. And that's going to, you know, going to let all of the other people go, no, see, he made it. No, I worry about the message that comes out of it. Because not everyone has access to the best healthcare money can buy. Not everyone has a $100 million podcast deal with Spotify, which would give you the ability to have a team of the best doctors. Just my thoughts. Love to hear yours. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1859. That was the day the first Pullman sleeping car made an overnight trip. The first Pullman sleeper was a renovated day coach. That first trip was made on the Chicago and Alton Railroad between Bloomington, Illinois and Chicago. Pullman continued to improve his sleeping cars to make long-distance train travel more comfortable and luxurious. Inspired by company towns in Essen, Germany and Saltire, England, Pullman bought land south of Chicago to build his company town. He named his new town Pullman and moved all of his manufacturing operations there. There were other sleeping cars at that time, but George Pullman refined the sleeping car and built a monopoly. As for his company town, initially it seemed to be a great success. Visitors to Chicago flocked to Pullman to view the model town. But then there was a severe economic depression in 1893. This caused Pullman to lower the wages of his employees. However, Pullman did not also lower the rents he charged to live in the company town. Prices of goods for sale in the town were not lowered either. Disgruntled workers went on strike. Many of the strikers joined the American Railway Union, started by Eugene V. Debs. This union organized a boycott, and railroad workers across the country refused to service any train with a Pullman car. The U.S. Attorney General issued an injunction demanding that the strikers cease in their activities or face being fired. Eventually, President Cleveland sent in federal troops to end the boycott. As a result, 30 workers were killed across the nation. Pullman died a few years later, and today, his Pullman Palace car that transformed the transportation industry is a relic of history. But his legacy of slashing wages lives on. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
On June 25, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So President Biden today said Texas law SB8 went into effect. He said this extreme Texas law blatantly violates the constitutional rights established under Roe versus Wade and upheld as precedent for nearly half a century. He goes on to say, my administration is deeply committed to this, to the constitutional right established in Roe versus Wade nearly five decades ago, and will protect and defend that right. This is our Supreme Court doing its best to ensure that, well, we turn the clock back to the good old days where gays were in the closet, women were back in the barefoot in the kitchen, and, well, we had people picking stuff in the fields. The good old days, that's where we're heading back to, thanks to our conservative corporate Supreme Court. So, hey, good times. Good times, Ed. And not only that, we're going to turn our neighbors into spies. Wow. They spend a lot of money dreaming this stuff up. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on this and all of the other top stories of the day, I've asked our good friend Bob Ney to come talk with us. Bob is a former Ohio congressman and also one of my favorite political analysts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you, Rick.
So what do you make of this SB8 coming out of Texas? Are you surprised that the Supreme Court let it go?
Well, yes. I thought maybe they would take it up, but they have taken it up by letting it go, if that makes sense. What they've done, of course, with the Texas law, it says that it bans abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, and it also allows for citizens to sue other citizens who are obviously pregnant women that, quote, violate the law, which is really a bizarre twist.
Ed, where did that come from? I can now see like a Dog the Bounty Hunter kind of reality show based on, you know, Dog the Pregnancy Hunter, and they're going to cash in on getting people turned in. I can now see this becoming one of those kind of cop shows where we shame people not only by taking them to court, but we plaster their face all over things. This is crazy stuff, Bob.
Well, the civil suit in this, file that suit is bizarre in itself because, you know, it's one thing that they pass the law and by the way, it bans abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, but it bans abortions where an ultrasound detects what the law defines as fetal heartbeat. So there's actually kind of two parts to that, which, you know, how do you determine, is it the 6 weeks or the fetal heartbeat? You know, how are they going to determine that? And if you're going to file a suit on somebody, how do you file that suit? Putting that in there just absolutely makes zero sense. I don't know where that came from. Somebody obviously asked for that to be in there. Somebody pushed for it to be in there. And I just don't understand the lawsuit part of it.
Well, no, I do. I understand it completely. This is about pitting everyone against each other and making everyone suspicious of everyone and giving men the power to go after their girlfriends or their wives to make them do what they want them to do under penalty of law. And if the woman does what she wants to do, they can go win a $10,000 prize.
And file a lawsuit. And the Supreme Court, of course, didn't act on the emergency petition from the abortion providers in Texas who wanted to stay the law. And that law came into effect, of course, midnight, September 1st. And then there's the Mississippi, which I think is 15 weeks, if I remember right, the
yes.
Mississippi law. So what the Supreme Court's doing by not acting is acting, because then this is allowed to go. And, of course, that doesn't mandate that across the United States, but if other states follow suit, naturally, if the lawsuit wasn't taken up on Texas or Mississippi, most likely it's not going to be taken up on other states.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's one of those things where it's going to fall back on the states, and
right.
you know, more progressive states are going to have it safe and legal, and the death states, the red states, are going to punish women for this, and you're going to end up having people who, and I've said this from the start, this is only to attack poor and working class women, because the rich women are going to be able to go to those progressive states and get whatever care that they need because they have the resources to do it. It's
right.
going to be the poor and the working class who are forced back into the back alleys.
Right. So now, I don't know if this will ever be considered, you know, by the Supreme Court. I don't know. And then they would actually kind of have to make a stand. So by, again, not making a stand, they made a stand.
Isn't the Mississippi case on the docket, though?
Right.
For some reason,
yes.
I thought they took that Mississippi case. So, I mean, basically, by not taking this, they've signaled that there aren't four votes to move forward on this. And, you know, I'm this is the way I'm reading it, and you can tell me if you think I'm wrong. They didn't stop this when all you need are four votes to take on a case. And they
right.
could have combined it with the Mississippi case, I think. You know, I'm not a lawyer, but that sounds reasonable to me.
Well, that's true.
So it seems to me that this is what they're signaling, that they're just chucking Roe out the door.
Right. Yeah, because this case does come as the justices have agreed to consider the Mississippi law during the upcoming term.
So this is, again.
So you're right.
This is one of those moments where, you know, a lot of people now are going to be looking at Joe Biden to go, hey, it's time to try the FDR thing. It's time to start packing the courts.
Yeah, no, I mean, of course, that'll never go through. So I think people are going to have to, you know, realize, you know, when they want the Supreme Court to have the appointments that they prefer, then got to make sure they get the president in there that they want.
Yeah, no, this
now,
comes...
it just so happened this term under Trump had, you know, a lot of appointments.
No, no, I'm right there with you. Elections have consequences, and
they
this
do.
Is one of those. And look, I'm not a big abortion guy. It's not my issue. It never has been my issue. In fact, personally, I'm against the idea. I would never have one, but guess what? I'm never going to get pregnant, so it's a moot point. But I do want it safe and legal. And moreover, for me, it's this especially, it's that part about pitting neighbors against each other and creating, you know, this bounty scenario where, you know, we're going to be hunting down people. And, you know, how dare you had a miscarriage. I don't think that was an accident. Boy, I can just see nothing but tragedy here.
I mean, I can't recall, maybe I'm wrong, but I can't recall previous laws, no matter what they were, that involved somebody being able to file a suit on somebody else over an abortion decision.
Yeah, and here's the really freaky thing about this, and this is just blowing my mind. The state of Texas is willing to give someone $10,000 to convict someone who had an abortion, but they won't give that mother $10,000 to feed her children.
Feed the kids, right.
That is just crazy to me. But it's the world that we now live in. It's the the QOP that has taken over the Republican Party. I want to get your thoughts on what's going on in Afghanistan. You know, Biden's taking some real heat over what I think was an incredible task of getting that many people out as quickly as they did. Personally, I'm surprised there weren't more casualties and more horrible things. But boy, I'll tell you, there are some folks who they're doing nothing but tearing into Biden.
Well, he's taking heat, and I mean, if you take the issue, and here's what I think it boils down to: if you take the issue of should we get out, and did he make the right decision on getting out, the answer is unequivocally yes. Americans, you know, sure, when it started, 88% wanted us to go in there, and when it ended, 88% wanted us out, all right? So there is no question he made the right decision. And now it's boiling down to, you know, the, for example, the Bagram Air Force Base, and the military says one thing a little bit juxtaposed from the White House, but yet the White House stands on a great point. You know, they took military advice, and the military said, well, we thought they wanted us to protect the, you know, the embassy in Kabul, you know, which might be the case. And then, of course, we, you know, closed Bagram Air Force Base. The intel, you know, and here goes our intel agencies again, which we could do an entire one of your shows on that. Yeah. But, Rick, here goes the intel again, signaling, no, it's going to be okay, you know, when it wasn't okay. So I think in the end, it's going to boil down to these, you know, also these 250 Americans that are there, of which some won't leave no matter what. Some do want to leave, and the president's, you know, doing whatever they're doing, I think, behind the scenes, you know, with talking and negotiating, by the way, as 97 other countries are also doing, you know, with their people over there. At some point in time, when you look at it, it was successful. 120,000 some people moved. You know, and we had some casualties, as you said. That's unfortunate, but it, you know, it could have been a lot more. And I think as this would calm down, that, you know, it would be basically understood and more accepted. I think the political system itself is going to, you know, rejuvenate this whole argument when they conduct hearings at some point in time, I think in October.
Yeah,
you know,
look,
I don't understand the hearings on this one. I really don't.
I don't either. If you want hearings, I want to know how we got into this. I want to know how for 20 years we threw money down a hole and we allowed generals to keep telling us that they were building an army that was nothing but a paper tiger and not even that. And how we pissed away $3 trillion to build a house of cards that fell in less than in 2 weeks. And how you had a president of the country flee with, you know, boxes of cash to allow the country to fall. Those are worth having a hearing. The Herculean leap that took us to gather everybody else up and get out, that's not what we hear over. And for me, the answer of this is not the attack on Biden. My problem is with the generals. You know, how did they not know that the house of cards they built was going to fall?
Right. And here's the thing, again, you know, if people look at it on the surface of it, you know, they wanted us out, he got us out.
Yep.
Had he done something different, it would have been really bad, but he got us out. He did it as fast as they could for the least amount of casualties then that would be involved on all, you know, all sides of this. There's a statement that the president made that is, you know, is causing a stir, and his statement early on was what you just addressed, when he said publicly, you know, that Afghanistan's not going to fall. And again, he was given intel sources.
That's the generals, in my view.
Yeah, I would be delighted, you know, if the president, you know, directed whoever in the White House to bring these people to the front who tell these things. And why do they tell these things, and how inept are they, or how bad is our intel? I'll go back to beating the dead horse of Iraq.
Yep.
You know, the people that stood there and lied, you know, I was in the room that lied to all of us. You know, for once and for all, I would love to see, you know, the president come out and go after these people. And the president could say, this is what I was told. And why was I told this? I mean, if I were the president right now, I would want to know why he was told to make a public statement that said, oh, it's not going to fall.
Yep. No.
He didn't make that up on his own.
No, that wasn't an ad lib deal. No.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. But, you know, here's the thing. You know, had he had to get out by May 1st, he was able to get an extra couple of months. How bad would it have looked like if we had to get out by May 1st?
Oh, that would have been tough.
Yeah, we couldn't have done it, and the people would be stranded there. But because he was able to negotiate a little bit bigger window, we got out. And I got the other people on the other side going, well, he should have negotiated. We should have stayed longer. We should have asked for another month, 2 months, another year. And my position on this is going, do you really want to put people in that kind of danger for that long? Because every month we stay, every day we stay, that's more more exposure our soldiers and our people would face.
Yeah, it had to end. It was a dual military-civil mission, as I said on your show before. Yep. I sat in the embassy with Sheila Jackson Lee, Paul Kanjorski, and Dave Hobson in Kabul 3 months after we invaded. I sat in the embassy and heard them say, oh, it's a dual mission. It's a civil mission and a military mission. They tried that from day one, which is, you know, okay, they're going to try it. After about 4 or 5 years, I had went back. If it can't stand on its own at that point in time, when is it going to be able to stand on its own? Another 16 years? You know, and it still couldn't stand on its own. The idea of the nation building from the beginning was a concept that was wrong. It was wrong.
Yep. And I think Biden was right when he said,
evil, you know, go after Osama bin Laden, who fled. You know, that's all fine. But the continuation of the nation building and the civil mission was wrong.
I think Biden was also right when he said, if it were any other country, we wouldn't have done it. We'd have been out of there a long time ago, but it was Afghanistan. And we thought we could build that up to make it whatever. Sure. I think he's right. I think if it were any other country, we would not have been there that long. We'd have gone, fulfilled our mission to kill bin Laden and gotten out. We won the war. The war is over. Joe Biden brought the troops home. That's it. That's end of story.
And you know, on another look at this, and call me over-optimistic or, I don't know, call me whatever. I've got rose-colored glasses. At least, if we can look on the good side of this, I mean, first of all, the soldiers did a beautiful mission under a tough situation. That's first. And second of all, at least for that period of time, even though we should have left earlier, you know, a lot of people were able to, you know, get a hold of their lives or maybe move to other countries or, you know, at least get some education. And hopefully there's enough, you know, resilience in there that they have a chance. I'm talking about the Afghans, you know, the Afghan people.
Yeah, they got to do it themselves, though.
That's it. Right, exactly. Yeah. But, I mean, I'm just saying, if somebody says it was 100% loss, no.
Didn't lose.
It's not 100% loss.
Didn't lose. We didn't lose. We should be having parades for the people who we brought home and for the people who fought in this, and we should be taking care of the people that we sent over there. That's it, bottom line.
Nonsense about... Let's not make this a... what we did with the Vietnam veterans.
Nope. All this nonsense about, oh, we look shameful or we look weak. Nonsense. We won the war, fulfilled our mission, brought the people home. Let's have the parades, kiss the babies, do all that stuff, and move forward and let Afghanistan be who they are. Now, I wanted to ask your question about this Mark Wayne guy. Mark Wayne Mullen, a Republican representative from Oklahoma. I don't know if you've seen this story. Evidently, he put in a call to the U.S. ambassador in Tajikistan. I guess that's how it's sent. Evidently, threatening the embassy staff because I guess he wanted to try to go into Afghanistan. What is the protocol for a representative to go into a hostile nation?
Now he wanted to go into Afghanistan.
That's what it's saying. He needed assistance in transporting a huge amount of cash into the country, saying he was going to neighboring Afghanistan to rescue 5 American citizens, a woman and her 4 children stuck in the country. They planned to hire a helicopter. He was going to go in like Rambo. He was going to go in. He was going to bring people out.
I mean, the procedure, if he wanted to go, would be that he would have to get a visa. I don't know what he was planning to try to do. You know, I mean, he would have to get a visa, and so he wanted to fly to another country. I'm assuming.
Yeah, he wanted to
Tajikistan or Tajikistan or one of those countries.
Right.
It would have to be.
Evidently, he told him about the embassy that he planned to fly from Tbilisi, Georgia. Into Tajikistan's capital, Dushanbe, I guess.
Yeah, Dushanbe, and that's Tajikistan, right.
And then he wanted to, over the next few hours, he needed a top diplomat's help to go in and grab these people. And the embassy told him no. But you know, this was what he planned on doing, and he threatened everybody along the way to let him do this, which is just kind of weird.
Well, as a member of Congress, he could pull off going there. You know, he's not a diplomat, and if the diplomats are banned, I'm assuming you said he wanted to take cash.
Yeah, he wanted to bring a whole bunch of cash with him.
Well, I'm assuming that could be a problem, because if you're going to enter, he's not a diplomat, and if you're going to enter, if he was going to enter Tajikistan, he would have a problem. He would need prior permission on moving cash.
Yeah, because
he would need prior approval of that country to enter a country with cash like that. It was a large amount.
Yeah, and basically they told him no.
Okay, well, so that would have been his problem. I mean, as far as if he wants to go and he can get the American side to give him a visa, he could go. And members of Congress, for example, could go to Cuba when other people couldn't go to Cuba. So you've got a little more leeway. But if he was moving cash, he would had to have had prior approval, and that would be a problem.
But there you go. Mark Wayne Rambo going to go into...
Wow.
I guess that makes for good campaign fodder.
Yeah, I don't know. Let's see. We have to see what kind of ads he runs.
Yeah, I'm in favor of him going. Good. Go. Good luck.
Let's see what he runs. But yeah, taking cash is a problem. I don't care if you're a member of Congress or not. You've got to have prior permission. So yeah,
personally, I think it was a setup. I think he just wanted the press. But
the press for it.
Yeah, it's just how things work. But Bob, I appreciate the time. As
Thank
always,
you.
Great stuff.
Thank you.
So September 18th, mark it on your calendar. Evidently, there's a rally being planned in Washington, D.C., what I'm calling Insurrection 2.0. It looks like the traitors and the domestic terrorists are planning a repeat. Interesting. I don't know that I would give them permits at this point. Now, I know you have the right to redress your government's of grievance. You have the right to assemble, all that stuff. But I got to be honest, the people who these are the people who attacked our Capitol. These are the people who put bombs around our Capitol. These are folks who, if you read their social media, are just foaming at the mouth for civil war. These are people who fetishize and fantasize about shooting their neighbors. They are planning a rally where you have a member of Congress cheerleading them on. This is the scary moment in which we live. Now they're getting all their practice and they're all their warm-ups, going to school board meetings. But this is one of those moments where my mind is, okay, going to have the big rally. We called in the National Guard. We brought our troops home from Afghanistan. We dealt with terrorists there. I guess we have to deal with them here. And, you know, there's part of me that goes, these folks have a track record. Maybe we give them what they say they want. A very strong arm, military type presence to ensure that they're peaceful and they're the patriotic Americans they claim to be. And not the thugs that have been, well, spewing. Now, interestingly enough, I think most of them are just loudmouths, like the guy out in the eastern part of Pennsylvania who said, we're going to go in with my 20 buddies and we're going to throw those bums out and we're going to install our people. When someone really asked the question, and with the potential of him going to jail, he backpedaled really quickly. Maybe this is where we have to go, because sadly we're being ripped apart. I mean, I look at what's going on, what coming out of Afghanistan has gotten us. There are people who are truly happy that there was a hiccup, that there was something that went wrong. And in every mission, there's always going to be something. Yeah, I spent a little time today reading about the Russians leaving, withdrawing from Afghanistan. And man, it was ugly. But they didn't have social media and, well, they didn't have our conservatives. If you missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Follow us on social media, at Rick Smith Show on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all of those. always ways to interact with the program. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.